Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today. The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Hello and welcome to The Price of Football, the show that looks at the money behind the beautiful game and is currently getting its excuses ready ahead of tonight's big, big match. I'm Kevin Day, supporter of God's Own Team, and he's Kieran Maguire, Brighton fan. Come on, Kieran, we're bigger than that. Let's not bring God into this. You nervous?
Oh, I'm absolutely terrified.
Yeah,
I hate playing Palace. It's every time you get the ball in our half, I'm going, Jesus Christ, they're going to score. They're going to get a breakaway, or we're going to get an own goal. Yeah, you know, it's a horrible, horrible. It's not just the 90 minutes, because beforehand it's always a bit, you know, it's a bit tense. Mm. And afterwards it can, especially if we lose, it's just an abomination.
Yeah, well, an abomination, that's worse than an abomination, isn't it? It's a double abomination. Well, I wouldn't worry about too much about us getting the ball in your half. I'm more worried about Fulham, to be perfectly honest. They're little shifty little buggers sneaking up on us. Anyway, Kieran, it's questions day, but we do have a couple of big news stories to discuss first, not the least the success of our quiz last night, once again. Who knew that Watley's Partners Evidence had come back?
No, I was amazed.
Oh, yeah. Well, I was amazed that you were so excited, considering you'd never had your lips around one, but that's a dangerous thing to say as well.
Well, especially, yeah. Isn't that actually relates to one of the questions. No,
Let's not do it, because it happened last night, Kieran, remember?
Yes.
The big story, Kieran, is National League North and South. They've both voted to declare the season over, null and void, done, finished, extinct. So that's that then, or is it?
Well, on first glance, it is, but we've got, Gloucester City, who mysteriously are in National League North.
Yes.
I'm not great on geography, but...
Yeah, I know, Well, it's north of us anyway. Let's put it that way.
It's north of us, yeah. Yeah. Well, most places are north of me, to be
fair. That's true. Fair point.
And they are saying, well, there was sort of half a dozen clubs that did want the season to continue. So why don't we have our own little competition instead? Because they're doing quite well.
Dorking as well, I think. You were the head of National League South saying the same thing. They're both looking to take legal advice, apparently.
So there were a series of votes which looked increasingly complicated. The National League itself has voted to carry on the season. Yeah. The National Leagues North and South both voted to have the season declared null and void. But then the National League appeared to have come out and said, oh, by the way, there's going to be promotion and relegation.
Right.
And you're going, well, okay, but if you take a look at the tables, we've got some clubs in National League North having played 18 games and other clubs having played only 11. So points per game seems very, very harsh to judge any way, shape or form who goes up or down. And then if you think about promotion from National League North and South, it's done on a playoff basis. So if they declare the season null and void, what happens there? Are they going to host a little separate competition? There's not a lot of white smoke coming out of the chimney of the National League itself, which isn't helping things. And everybody's taking pot shots. that there are vested interests in this, and there's nothing wrong with saying we've got a vested interest, i.e. we're at the arse end of the table, we've got nothing to play for, what's the point? Equally, we've got some clubs saying, well, we're having a fantastic season, it seems harsh to punish us. So you can understand clubs operating in their own best interests. Just be fair and come out and say that. But it's going to drag on, sadly, for a while longer. And if I had a silver tongue, I'd be rubbing my hands together with glee at present. I think there's a little bit of work around the corner.
Yeah, well, I was going to say we could probably ask our friend Nick DeMarco, but I doubt if anybody at that level can afford Nick DeMarco, to be perfectly honest. But you know, Kieran, if your team's not playing on a Saturday afternoon, it's an actual pleasure to sit back and relax and watch Jeff Stelling introduce the scores. I mean, it's a masterclass of broadcasting, but he was pretty much, and his team, Hartlepool, operate in the National League, and he was pretty much saying, as National League scores came in, that apart from the four or five teams that were involved at the top, he just kept saying, well, these are meaningless games because no one's going down by the look of it. So why are we playing these games? If the idea is that we need to save money for these clubs at these levels, these games are pointless. And it seems that the two clubs leading, there's been an 18-club petition trying to overturn this decision, and their legal advice apparently is based on the fact that there were no alternative offers to declaring the season null and void. They were given just that option, should we declare it null and void, which is an interesting one. But all this idea that the clubs that could possibly get promoted carry on playing games in their own minor league seems an odd one. But it's like you say, it's not going to go away. And sometimes it makes you wonder about the naivety of the people running these leagues. You think, well, we've had a vote, that'll put an end to it, when clearly there's so much at stake for the clubs that could get into, either into the National League or from the National League into League Two.
Yeah, I think the decisions have been made too quickly, and the potential consequences don't appear to have been thought through. You would think there would be a period of consultation before and trying to get a bit more consensus, but it does seem now that there's a lot of distance between quite a few of the clubs and those at the head of the National League. Now clearly, given that some of the clubs have petitioned for some of the executives of the National League to be sacked, or things of that nature, there is a breakdown in relationships, and relationships are critical regardless of the business. And football's a very emotional business, but if you've got poor relationships between executives and industry corporations, then there are going to be problems.
But we know we have experienced football people at the head of the national leagues, and I'd be really intrigued to hear from them if producer Guy would like to invite some of them on, because that lack of consultation is even more baffling when you work out what that cost them before the decision to allocate the money from the National Lottery, because there was no real consultation about that, and that bit them in the bum. So you'd think the last thing they would do is make decisions without due process beforehand. But as I say, there's no point in you and I speculating about that, but if somebody from the National League would be happy to come on and have a grown-up discussion, we'd be very happy. Talking of grown-ups, Kieran, Sunderland, finally, it seems, have been... did you hear that old cliche about you know you're getting old when policemen look much younger? And the club owners can't be 23, Kieran, but Sunderland, it looks like it's done and dusted at Sunderland.
Yes, it has all now been confirmed. Louis Dreyfus has taken over. We're not quite sure what percentage of the club he's acquired. I think it's around about 84. There's talk that Stuart Donald still owns some, and the Uruguayan politician still owns a portion of the club. Whether they are looking for exit routes or whether they're going to try to hang on in the hope that Louis Dreyfus can get Sunderland back to the Premier League and therefore they can sell their stakes for higher fees, we don't yet know. But I think it's good news for the fans that Stuart Donald came in. He said all the right things, but you've got to walk the walk as well. And some of the issues in relation to Sunderland, such as the writing off some of the loans owed by the club, looked uncomfortable. And it appeared that he was just trying eventually to, a bit like we see with Dion Dublin and Holmes Amlohamy, he effectively came in, tried to flip the club, make a bit of money, and disappear. without spending too much money himself. And that's come back to bite him, I think, certainly reputationally.
And again, if Dion Dublin's listening, if he'd like to come on and explain his fascination with stairs on Homes Under the Hammer, which we're all fascinated with Dion's fascination with stairs. It's how you get from one floor to the other, says Dion on a weekly basis. Final news story, Kieran, and it's possibly a good one. As you predicted just last week, the UK government has offered to host the entire Euros if necessary, because they're so optimistic about the progress of the vaccination and various other things. So from a purely home-centric point of view, this has got to be good news, and it seems to make sense as well. We've got the logistics and the infrastructure for it, haven't we?
Yes, so there wouldn't need to be any stadia built because we've already got enough grounds which will hold 40,000. There's good transport links. Whether fans will be allowed or what numbers will be fans be allowed is yet uncertain. Oliver Dowden, I think, would be very pleased, and I think the government would be very pleased because the success of the vaccination to date has certainly increased optimism. My only concern is if it does take place and then infections rise on the back of it, it will look pretty awful. But we certainly have got the capacity to do it. It's now really a case of what's UEFA's approach. They will be reluctant to have it taking place in so many different centres. Mm. Although we have seen in respect of the Champions League and the Europa League that we are muddling through, even if some of the matches are taking place at random venues.
Yeah, whatever you think of this government, Kieran, it does seem that if something appears in the Sunday Times, there is some truth in it. And I make no link whatsoever between the Sunday Times and its relationship with Michael Gove. That's probably just coincidence. But the Sunday Times reporting yesterday that both football and music are expected to be allowed to have people in by the end of May would indicate that there is some thought towards getting the Euros. And it would be a big feather in the, let's face it, there's an election coming up in a couple of years. That's the sort of thing they would point to, isn't it? We got the Euros, but it is kind of good news. It's kind of optimistic news. And it looks at least as though the tournament will be going ahead, which we weren't convinced by in January, were we?
No. I think the fact that football has managed to get through this far, and we've had a return to UEFA's club competitions, surely the logic would be that the national competitions must be able to take place as well.
And you won't get your trip to Moscow, Kieran. That's the only downside.
Well, I think I'm still barred.
Never mind. That was mentioned at the quiz last night. Patrick Green is our first question, as it's Questions Day. For those of you who don't know, for new listeners, we do news stories on a Thursday and we do questions on a Monday. Well, it's still, this lockdown might be lifting slightly, Kieran, but it's still hard to know what day of the week it is. Patrick Green says, I have become a big fan of your show, having binge listened to all the episodes while I work part-time in a boring accounting practice in Belfast. Firstly, Patrick, don't binge listen. Always listen responsibly. And secondly, I can't actually see Kieran's face, but I can imagine the look on it at the notion of a boring accountancy job. That simply won't. But Kieran won't be able to counsel us that. But Patrick reveals, Kieran, that he's an accounting student. You might like to rethink that, Patrick, considering you find it so boring. But Patrick's also a football fan and a player of amateur league football in Holywood over there in Northern Ireland. What are the chances, Kieran, says Patrick, this is a good general question, of Northern Irish football growing financially? And we've talked about the new UEFA competition for clubs, but what possible benefit could that competition bring to clubs financially?
Well, if we take a look at those questions in turn for Patrick, in terms of the potential growth of Northern Ireland football, I think it will be pretty challenging. If you take a look at the three main sources of revenue for a football club, you've got ticket sales, broadcasting and commercial. Mm. Now, if we take a look at the Northern Ireland Premiership, we've got five clubs who have got ground capacities of 2,500 or less. So you've got Cliftonville, Coleraine, Newry, Ards and Warren Point. So even if there's some sort of uptick, you know, perhaps post-COVID people want to go out and meet up at football matches and so on, there's an automatic ceiling due to the capacity of the grounds.
Yeah.
The broadcast deal realistically isn't going to be there because you're competing against Sky Sports and BT, who have got the Premier League matches. And also, yeah, we've got to be honest and take into consideration the historical links with both England and Scotland. So that means that there are many football fans in Northern Ireland who will automatically be supporting Celtic, Rangers, Manchester United, Liverpool, Arsenal, because
Chelsea,
so I think there's a history and heritage issue which automatically caps the capacity of the domestic game. Certainly, you know, the success of the national team can increase interest, but that automatically tends to fade once the domestic season starts, because all the talk, all the newspapers are focusing on the major clubs who are getting the existing broadcasting from Sky and BT and the BBC and so on. I mean, you know, there is coverage in Northern Ireland TV.
Kieran, can I just jump in there? Because it seems every now and again on Sky, and it seems very random, very arbitrary, you will once in a 4-week period turn Sky on and there is Northern Irish football, but there seems to be no rhyme nor reason for how many times it's on or what games they choose. So there must be some amount of money. Obviously, it's not very big.
Yeah. The trouble is, if it's not very big, it means that the clubs can't pay much out in wages.
Ah, okay, right.
So if we sort of take a look at Linfield, in 2018, they generated $800,000 of revenue as a club.
Oh, right, okay.
That puts them on a par with National League North, National League South clubs. Okay. If they get their escape route is Europe.
Yeah.
So when they got into the Europa League playoffs in 2019, that trebled their income, but that still was taking them up to, you know, a top half National League, bottom half of the League Two, and that's only one club. So I think there's a natural ceiling in terms of what can be achieved there. But that sort of leads us into the UEFA Conference League, which is starting in 2021-22.
Is it?
And I'm amazed, you know, that so few people are talking about it.
Yeah, we've so little going on at the moment. You'd think this would be a massive talking point, wouldn't you?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And the one thing which intrigues me about this, at present, UEFA split their prize money, which comes from the TV companies. 80% goes to the Champions League, which has presently 32 teams, and 20% goes to the Europa League, which has 48 teams. When this new competition comes in, and I think we're moving to 32-32-32, I can't see the clubs in the Champions League giving up their 80%. So the amount of money involved in the Conference League, and I think clubs from Northern Ireland, and this is where it could be of benefit, in theory, I think they're going to have three qualifying teams for the knockout stage before you get into the group stage. So it could involve a wee bit more money. But even so, if you are a good player, I suspect you're going to be snapped up by clubs in England and Scotland, because you don't have to be generating a lot more money to be generating more money than the biggest club in Northern Ireland.
Mm. There will be a glorious time in a year or two, Kieran, when you're getting very angry about the Europa Conference League. And I'd say, come now, Kieran, we've only just come out of a pandemic. Let's calm down about this. But in the meantime, I can't imagine anybody getting really, really carried away for or against the Europa Conference League. But, yeah, better times are ahead. Steve Cutler is a Bristol Rovers fan and has always been interested in football finance, he says, because until recently, Rovers have basically only been one bouncing check away from a crisis. He would like any information on the club and their seemingly forward-thinking and big-picture board. Any information would be welcome, he says. And this is a bit of a gear change, Steve, how do footballers' pensions work? So what is the value? Who pays it and from who? See, this is people have a go at me for sounding like the Now Show, but if people send questions in with that massive gear change, I can't help but come over all whatever that bloke used to do gymnastics is. Anyway, so Bristol Rovers first, and then how do footballers' pensions work?
Right. Well, Bristol Rovers have been owned by Wael Al Qadi for the last 5 years. So he acquired the club in February 2016. That if you are from a Middle East background, the first reaction of a fan base is, "Wahey, yeah. We're the new Manchester City."
Yeah, of course.
And it turns out he's by you know your standards and my standards, he's a wealthy man. But you know most people are wealthy compared to you and I, Kevin. So
fair point.
So he does have some money, without doubt. Bristol Rovers have been losing around about 60 grand a week pre-pandemic. So were certainly being funded by him. I think the club is operated and controlled via Jersey through a company called Dwayne Sports. And this is where I always start to get slightly twitchy when people are using offshore companies, but you know the money's constantly has come in. In 2019, I think initially things weren't great in terms of the relationship. There was a striking off order which came from Companies House in 2019. That was dealt with.
What's striking off order? Sorry,
striking off order is effectively for the company to be wound up.
Oh, okay.
So you know it hadn't submitted documentation. It was late with this, that, and the other. People were not happy with the way it was running itself from a governance point of view. And what clubs always say, "Oh, admin error, blah blah blah." But yeah. You know, it's a bit like when the tax man asks you for some money. They normally ask three or four times with. So they start off politely and move to slightly more narky before they will finally say, "Right, we'll meet you in court." Companies now takes the same approach.
Yeah, we normally go straight to narky now. saves a lot of time. Sorry, Kim, just while we're on the subject, that striking off order, because this is something that's completely new to me, even after a year of doing this pod. Is that something, without mentioning the names of these clubs that we've talked about recently that haven't provided account details, is that something that they should be worried about? I mean, are you talking about 3 or 4 years of nothing, or you know, just a year of not providing accounts? Is that enough to start getting Companies House twitchy?
Theoretically, it could happen to any club. I mean, it did happen to Palace a couple of years ago, and I was surprised at the time because Palace had normally submitted their accounts on time. They were late 1 year, and it doesn't appear to be done automatically. Right. And there are other companies who haven't submitted any accounts for 5 or 6 years, and the striking off order doesn't apply. So I don't know how the algorithms or the systems work, but they do seem to be very hit and miss.
Okay. Back to Bristol Rovers then, sorry.
Back to Bristol Rovers. So in 2020, they did set up a new board of directors, and these people appeared to believe in communication, which is always good. Mm. There was a fans representative on the board, and things were clearly there was some bad blood between the fans representative on the board and the club. And I've tried to get further into this, but I'm still not certain what's going on. That fans rep ended up resigning, hasn't been replaced. I think that's due to a bit of a toxic relationship, which my understanding is starting to thaw. So that would be good if we do have fan communication on board. The other sort of elephant in the room in respect of Bristol Rovers is stadium. Mm. They've been playing at the Memorial Ground now since I can remember going to Bath to see them play to Bath Rugby Club. Mm. And sadly, I never got to Eastland. So it's one of my big regrets as a you know train spotter.
Eastville,
sorry.
Yeah, that's all right.
So there has been talk about a new stadium. and that's sort of come and gone. I think if that progressed, that would certainly help to push the club forwards. I mean, at present, they're at the towards the wrong end of League One. They've just sacked the manager. You know, things aren't great on the field, which tends to make tensions between owners and fans grow even worse.
So, sorry, just to clarify, Kieran, this Steve Cutler talks about the new forward thinking and big picture board, but that's not as a result of a takeover, a new owner, is it? It's just a different approach by that owner to the fans. Is that right?
That's right. So Wael Al-Qaadi, he has been seen and he has spoken to the local press, but I think he feels now that having a sort of a dedicated commercial director and chief executive who want to be more fan facing is beneficial, and that's an approach I would always encourage for all clubs, because you can solve an awful lot of problems by talking to people.
It's a mystery, Bristol, isn't it? Because it's we always talk about Plymouth. Why on earth has Plymouth never, with that huge catchment area, blah blah blah, sleeping giant, blah blah blah. But Bristol, Bristol should be able to sustain two Premier League clubs, let alone one and a Championship club, shouldn't it? But it never seems to quite happen for Bristol Football, for reasons that we probably haven't got time to explain, have we?
Yeah, I think we were asked, weren't we, a few weeks ago to sort of name four or five clubs who'd never been in the Premier League, who could get there. And we said Plymouth were one, and I think we said Bristol City was another one. It's certainly got the infrastructure there. Bristol City are owned by a guy that lives in the Channel Islands who is a billionaire. But that area of the country is rugby focused as much as football.
That's
and
true,
I think perhaps we don't really, because we are so football orientated, we don't realise that actually it's not just a split between the two football clubs. There's rugby as well. But then you could say the same about places in Yorkshire. You think about the strength of Super League. It's a tricky one.
So the Bristol City
fans... And then
moving
on to pensions.
Well, before we do that, I think we should acknowledge disgruntled Bristol City fans. If you're looking for someone to blame for your recent terrible run of form, it's Kieran Maguire for suggesting that you should be a Premier League club. So yes. that'll teach you. Anyway,
sorry about that. I'm doing really well when I suggested it.
Yeah. Kieran, I've got a question for you. How do footballers' pensions work, Kieran?
Well, historically, I remember when I was doing my tax exams, which was 1985 and 86, footballers used to be able to draw down a pension from when they reached the age of 35. But I think the rules have changed since then. What clubs do these days is that they just run as a similar scheme to other organisations. There is a Football League pension scheme which has a deficit, which I think the clubs have contributed into getting rid of that deficit. But players and clubs simply pay these days into a fund, and that's used to invest. And then when you reach retirement age, in terms of, I think you have to be 60 along with the rest of the population, you'll be able to draw a pension down from it. So it's no different to any other industry.
That seems, well, it doesn't seem harsh if you're working in a different occupation, but we've been talking to people like Dean Hammond recently about footballers and finances. And if you retire at the age of 35 and you've still got 25 years to wait for the pension that you've been paying some considerable amount into, that seems harsh. But then presumably you would advise them all to have private pension schemes, which presumably can be released earlier than that.
Yes, but also even if you are a professional footballer who has spent the majority of your career in the top two divisions, if you retire at 35, your life expectancy realistically is going to be 80 to 85. So to get a pension to pay out a decent sum of money for 50 years, you'd have to have paid a huge amount into it to begin with. So I think to a certain extent, it makes sense to say to players, you've got to think of alternative ways of generating income beyond football, because otherwise the pension you'll be receiving will be worth buttons. And the transition from going from being on you know, good money, you know, compared to the average wage to a footballer's pension would be pretty tough. If you've still got mortgage, you've got kids, you know, family commitments and so on, it simply wouldn't be worth receiving. So I think the 35 was an error because players were told, I'm going back, you know, to 35 years when I was doing my exams. Players were told, oh, you can draw your pension when you're 35. And players thought, oh, that sound, you know, I can retire. I'll be getting a decent sum of money from the pension. And then when they did find out the amounts that were being paid in the pension, they realised they couldn't afford to live. And that's when they had to go back into finding alternative forms of employment.
I left the ambulance service in 1988 and I recently had a letter inviting me to apply for the pension, which is both nice and also terrifying in a little bit of a way, but also made me really paranoid because just first thing I said to Ali was, how did they get my address? I've lived in loads of places since 1988. How did they know where I am now? That really worried me. There you go. That shows that I was sensible enough to pay the compulsory pension for 7 years when I was a young man, and now I'm reaping the benefit of a couple of hundred quid. It's a lump sum. I've never had a lump sum before, so I'm delighted with that. Robert Wood. Now, Robert Wood has a new angle on iFollow, but with Robert's new angle, I'm going to draw the line under iFollow for a while because we've been talking about it just about every week, and I think we've squeezed most of it out. But Robert says initially, so this is probably just a little bit of context for new listeners. Initially, says Robert, with barely any Sky matches in the lower two divisions, how popular is the iFollow service and how much money are clubs making from it? And what makes pay-per-view so much more worthwhile for League One and League Two clubs but not Premier League clubs, who presumably would attract a huge number of subscribers?
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car-selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Hi, I'm Steve Lamack, and every week I'm joined by Music Allies Head of Insight, Stuart Dredge, on The Price of Music, the weekly podcast all about the money behind the music industry. In each episode, we discuss the very latest goings-on in the music business and dig into the finances behind the big stories.
So whether you're a music lover who just wants to know more about what really goes on in the industry, or you're an aspiring musician, manager or label owner who wants some inside knowledge on how Spotify's financial model really works, or what the future holds for independent live music venues, this is a show for you.
Subscribe to The Price of Music in your podcast app now. See you soon.
Right, so there are clearly two issues here. The take-up of iFollow, I think, has been spectacularly good in the main for clubs in League One and Two. There were problems initially in terms of the quality of the service, trying to get a download and so on. Those have in the main been addressed. It's still not perfect. And we are seeing... We've got clubs such as Ipswich who are getting 8,000 people signing in for iFollow for a home match. Now, they get £8.33 per ticket sold because it's £10 and you've got to take VAT out of that. So it's substantially less than they would get for a match day, but it's money coming in. We are seeing, interestingly, clubs doing very well. The bigger clubs in League One, so the likes of Sunderland, Pompey and Ipswich, the likes of Bolton in League Two, they are getting quite often, 3,000 or more iFollow passes being sold for away matches. So, again, more money to benefit those clubs, and they certainly, and our friends at Lincoln, that they're getting 1,700 for away fans. And given, no disrespect to Lincoln, we're on really good terms with the club, and as an away fan, I've always enjoyed my trips there. It's a long way from most away matches, so for them to be able to sell 1,700 tickets, is good news for both the home team and themselves. So that's where we are. It has certainly helped. Now, in respect of the Premier League, in my view, and I know we've got friends in the broadcasting industry that will probably, you know, hold me to account on this. Mm. I think the Premier League have been spectacularly outmaneuvered and outsmarted by the broadcasters.
Right.
I would be willing to pay to watch my team each week.
Mm.
I would not be keen on paying 15 quid.
Mm.
So the broadcasters set the price at 15 quid. And then the fans groups and the FSA have been involved in this. The FSA, if you take a look at their documentation, their view is we're not opposed to pay-per-view in principle, but we don't think it's value for money at 15 quid a pop.
Yeah.
So if Sky and BT and said, right, it's going to be a tenner, then yeah, we'd have moaned. Yeah, given a choice between watching something for nothing or paying a tenner, I'd rather watch it for nothing. But I think an awful lot of fans would have signed up. If you take a look, I think at some of the matches, I think Arsenal versus Leicester, 140,000 passes were sold. You know, and we're saying League One, 8,000 is good. Yeah, 140,000, and that was at £15 a pop. That's £2.1 million worth of revenue for a single match. Again, substantially less than Arsenal would normally get, but yeah, it's still 2 million quid.
Yeah.
So what we've been left with now is the broadcasters paid to show half of the matches in the Premier League. They've ended up being given the whole lot without having to pay any more money.
Mm.
And we as fans are not having to pay any more money either. So the clubs have been manoeuvred. You know, part of this is a cultural thing that we think that, you know, subscribing to Sky and BT gives us the right to watch every match. But you take yourself back 12 months and Sky and BT have paid for 160 games. Out of the 380. So now we're seeing 380 games on TV. It's a little bit of negotiation cleverness, in my view, by the broadcasters.
Mm. Well, it would be interesting to hear what our friends in the broadcasting industry say about that, because it always seems to me like you're right, Kieran, so there's nothing new for me saying that. Our next question comes from a Watford fan. We won't hold that against him. Joe Etchells. Hello, Joe. Joe Etchells says that Watford recently announced their new higher education partner, which is a university campus of football business. What will each of the parties get from this partnership, says Joe? Presumably UCFB will pay to have their logo visible alongside our principal sponsors, but the word partnership implies more than mere sponsorship. Does it mean Watford players and staff, and perhaps fans, for example, could benefit from an education pathway, or is it simply sponsorship being labelled as a partnership?
If you talk to people in the commercial departments of clubs, and Paul O'Brien of Watford, their commercial director, has actually been on the podcast.
Indeed.
He's a big fan of ours, and vice versa. He's a very interesting guy to talk to. UCFB is a dedicated football college, university college. It's got campuses at Wembley, at the Etihad, and Turf Moor. I've taught at all three of them. I've given guest talks there. They've got some smart people working there. They've also got bases in Miami, New York, Toronto, Melbourne, places like that.
Mm-hmm.
They want to increase their profile. Right. So, you know, as far as they're concerned, it's by having a relationship with Watford, it does mean that people will be saying, well, what does that UCFB stand for? And perhaps investigate a bit further. From Watford's point of view, I would imagine the likes of Paul will now pop along and perhaps give a couple of guest talks, increases the profile of the club. They might be in a position where they can offer placements to some of the UCFB students because they've now got a closer relationship. And the one thing I say to everybody who's trying to get into the football business, ultimately, there's only 92 clubs. Doesn't matter how many colleges there are offering courses. There's only 92 clubs. What you've got to do is you've got to network. Yeah, and it's a horrible, horrible word. I hate it. You know, the idea of
talking to people. It makes me, you know, I'm just not a natural at it in terms of small talk and things of that nature. But from a business point of view, it's absolutely critical. So yeah, it will allow Watford perhaps to offer a couple of placements to work on projects. UCFB students will benefit from that. Watford will be able to perhaps go in and talk to the kids at the Wembley campus and the Etihad campus, and then they say, well, that guy, he asked some really smart questions. Let's take this a step further. So there are mutual benefits of building up relationships with organisations such as these. We do exactly the same at Liverpool. Yeah, I'll be honest. Yeah, we have our students going out on placement to clubs in the Premier League and overseas as well.
I'm with you on the networking thing. The amount of times I'll be at some kind of broadcasting do and somebody say, oh, there's a head of BBC comedy there. Do you want to go and say hello? No. Yes. Not really. If he wants me, he knows. The NHS know where I live. He can find out where I live as well. But it's a terrible, it's the wrong attitude, because you, unfortunately, some people are better at it than others, but you do need to build up. You know, it's in the same way that people leave university with a network of contacts. You do need to do it. But anything that provides education is good by the price of football. So we wish the UCFB, obviously, the best with that. Our next question is from Evan Morgan, which is quite a trippy question, but it's one that's probably worth it's a bit of a doomsday scenario, but it's one worth asking. Evan says that we've heard all about the City Football Group and their successful strategy for world domination, basically. But Evan says, I wonder if the dystopian future world of football looks like a City Football League formed of franchise City Group clubs that hoover up talent for an American-style draft system. After all, they have clubs all over the world already. I suspect Evan may be a United fan, Kieran.
It could be.
It is a bit of a doomsday sign, but I doubt very much whether City owners are in their lair underneath a volcano going, oh, damn, Evan's seen through our plan. But I know we're not looking at a world where the whole football globe is made up of Man City Group, are we?
No. And also, I think you've got to look at it from a cultural point of view. Who do Manchester City want to beat more than any other club on the planet? It's not Melbourne City. It's not New York City. It's not Mumbai City. It's Manchester United. It's Liverpool. It's Leeds. You know, so and that's part of football culture. And that is one of the Premier League's unique selling points. And I think that's never been more evident than what we've seen over the course of the last 6 or 7 months.
Yeah.
You know, under normal circumstances, you and I would not be polite at all to each other today, even though you know, we're supposed to be doing a professional podcast, because the match is taking place later, later on Monday night, and it's impossible to be pleasant to a Palace fan on match day. And that's how it should be. And then after the match, we can sort of grow up a bit. But I think from a football culture point of view, the fact that we have these amazing rivalries in the Premier League, in the EFL, and so on, is part of what makes the product so attractive and brings in global interest. If it's one franchise versus another, I think there'll be so much cynicism that, you know, matches are effectively being manipulated for whatever purposes, that they would struggle to build a much interest in it.
Yeah, I'd just like to point out, Kieran, that whether we grow up after the game tonight is entirely dependent on what the score is, to be perfectly honest. If you win, then I will expect a mature adult approach from both of us, but I'm not going to promise that if we win. This is the other side to Evan's worries, is a proper good news story. And Jamie Bennett, and I apologise because I tried to work out the proper pronunciation of this, but I couldn't even work out the phonetic alphabet when I looked it up. But Jamie Bennett talks about Norwegian club Bodø Glimt, who recently won their first league title in Norway and in a stadium that holds around 7,000 people. Jamie says, can Kieran detect any financial secrets behind this unlikely rise, or is it simply the sort of romantic sporting achievement all too rare in modern football?
It's the latter. I took a look at the financial records and bits of pieces of that nature. The average attendance of Bodø Glimt is 3,000. So
wow.
you know, it's not significant. They've done really well. They won the Norwegian main league by 19 points last season. They only just got beaten by Milan 3-2 in the playoffs for the Europa League. According to the scouting organizations, it's simply because they've got the best scout in Scandinavian football. His name is Kjetil Knudsen. He's got them playing a style of football which everybody understands. And, you know, sometimes keeping it simple is all you need. And by all accounts, it works. They've had no injuries. They put out a consistent 11 or 14, you know, in terms of the substitutions. And on the back of that, they've been winning matches left, right, and centre.
Yeah, it is a great story, isn't it? That 3,000 is slightly concerning. As I remember being in Oslo talking to fans of many English clubs, Norwegian fans, and all of them said they kind of patronise their local team and look out for the result, but they wouldn't particularly dream of going to see a Norwegian club play football as long as they could afford to fly to England. So, that again, it's a wonderful romantic story, but the dread hand of the Premier League is still involved, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's similar to what we were saying in respect of Northern Ireland. But I've lived in Manchester, or I lived in Manchester for 40 years. I've worked in Liverpool most of my working life. On a Saturday night in Manchester or Liverpool, when Manchester United or Liverpool are playing at home, you cannot find a hotel there are football tourists coming in, which is great for the local economy.
Of course.
Drunken Scandinavians, because clearly our alcohol prices compared to theirs are substantially lower, are an amazing local cultural phenomenon these days.
Yeah. Unless you're right in the middle of one of them, but that was fine. It was fun. 2 weeks afterwards, it was fun. Now, Mark Fleckney has a question that you and I, Kieran, ironically, you don't drink, but you probably won't remember this. I do, or it's a fake memory. But this is a question you and I actually discussed in our first ever meeting in a pub, the Blue Posts, in London's fashionable Fitzrovia. Oh, God, I miss pubs. Mark has some sub-questions, but I want to concentrate on the big one. And again, it's probably something we could talk about in the entire book. But basically, says Mark, can England actually sustain 92 professional league clubs? And I think this is a really good question historically, Kieran, because it's not a massive country, and yet it has 92 professional football clubs.
Well, it has more than 92 professional football clubs.
Of course it does, yes, of course.
The National League is effectively Division 5.
Oh, yeah, fair point.
And it used to be, you know, I think when you and I first started going to football, I was living in Chelmsford. I used to go and watch Chelmsford City. They were not a full-time club. They were in the old Southern League. And there was never any chance of them thinking of going full-time. But we've now got, you know, two-thirds of the clubs in the National League are full-time. Is it sustainable? Part of me says no, because the clubs are all losing money. You know, 23 out of 24 in the National League were losing money, I think. The vast majority of the clubs in League One and League Two, the Championship's a car crash and so on. So how has it survived? How has it sustained itself in recent years, given those circumstances? It's come down to the fact that football attracts people with money to own them. And it is the funding model, which has come from rich people coming in, or modestly rich people coming in, to allow the clubs to make losses and underwrite those losses, which has allowed us to still have 92 clubs. If they were to stop that funding, what would happen? Well, my gut reaction would be that we would still probably have 92 football clubs, but wage levels would fall as a result of that. Because ultimately, wages are driven by income, and we've got the standard income plus the owner's money coming in, which is then paid out to the players. So if you reduce the income, whether that's from TV, match day, or whatever,
that's going to have an impact. My biggest concern about the sustainability of English football is what's happening in the Champions League, because if we go from we laugh about the Europa Conference, but if the Champions League proposals, which are to go from 125 to 225 matches a season, something's got to give, and the value of the domestic TV deals are likely to fall. And given that clubs are significantly dependent upon solidarity payments being dropped down from the Premier League into the lower leagues, I think that could be very dangerous unless clubs manage to get costs under control. And that's kicking in 2024. And you know, I know we say, well, the Super League's not going to take place. This isn't going to take place. All that's going to happen is that the Super League proposed by JP Morgan and Joel Glazer and co, it's a lot of that is going to be embedded into the new Champions League format to keep those clubs from you know, jumping ship and forming their own competition.
This next question is sort of linked. I'm going to give producer Guy the benefit of the doubt here and say he didn't just throw all the questions up in the air and see what happened. It comes from Kevin Wilson, and I think this is a very interesting question, actually. Of course, all our questions are interesting, but this is an aspect that we haven't really discussed. And Kevin says, with Scotland qualifying for the Euros, how much is this worth to the SFA? And also, this is the really interesting question, is there an estimated account for how you would judge what qualifying can do for a national economy? Now, because that's a good question, Kim. We often talk about the economic benefits of a successful club on the local community, but how about on the country as a whole?
Right. In terms of the first part of Kevin's question, what I did is I went in to the accounts of the Football Association of Wales for 2016, because Wales qualified for the Euros that year. Their revenue doubled from 10 to 20 million. So it had a huge impact upon the capacity of the Welsh Football Association to then, you know, invest in grassroots and things of that nature. So it will have a significant impact. The Scottish Football Association generates around about 35 to 40 million. I think, you know, potentially we're looking at 10 million on top. That will be tempered, of course, if no fans are able to attend matches. So going back to sort of one of the topics we were looking at earlier, it would be good if we could have crowds for a variety of reasons, of course. So that would be positive. In terms of impact upon gross domestic product, i.e. the economy as a whole, I think we have to be a little bit careful here, because you will see in sort of the mainstream media, and this isn't, I'm not going all Donald Trump here, criticizing the mainstream media. There'll be talk of, you know, it's a boom time for the economy, you know, the pubs are full. Yeah, and let's park COVID to one side. Let's assume that we've made sufficient progress by the time we get to June that people can socialize. What we talk about from an economic perspective is what's referred to as a zero-sum game. If more money is being spent by consumers on hospitality and food and drink, by definition, you must be spending less money on other things. So if people are going, right, well, Scotland are playing, you know, such and such tonight, the cinemas will be empty. The theatres, people won't be going out to restaurants because they'll be going to the pubs instead.
Yeah.
So they won't necessarily be spending more money. They will be spending money which is very much concentrated on individual industry. So in a World Cup year, and if you take a look at, I'm a bit of a geek. In a World Cup year, the sales of televisions go up. Because what do we do? Well, you know, I have some of my mates around, want to impress them. Yeah, you get so lots of people going out and they're buying the latest 55-inch 8K television with Dolby, this, that, and the other. So, you know, John Lewis and Curry's do really well in the 3 months leading up to the World Cup, because blokes being blokes, they like gadgets. So but that means that they're not spending money on other things. Then you come to the economic impact
on the country which is hosting the tournament. Now, I appreciate that, you know, Scotland is a partial host. What we have seen, and I've taken a look at economic impact reports, is that when a country is pitching to host the World Cup, it will get in a firm of management consultants who will put out a glossy 60 or 70 page brochure to convince the government it's a really good idea, saying, you know, it increases exposure for the country, you've got all these tourists coming, there'll be legacy benefits because people will get more into sport, so therefore there will be a positive impact on national health, which will reduce the necessity, you know, in terms of the National Health Service and all of these things. And it's all hogwash, it's all absolute nonsense. I went to the World Cup in 2010 in South Africa, had a fantastic time, absolutely glorious. South African people, superb hosts, met so many people from other countries. So from a cultural point of view, going to matches, it was absolutely wonderful. Went back to South Africa a couple of years later with the Baroness, and in Cape Town, the stadium is now mothballed. It was exactly the same in Brazil in 2016. You've got train links to stadiums where the stadium's no longer being used, so therefore the train link gets mothballed. So in terms of the positive economic impact, it is vastly overstated. They normally end up costing the country that is hosting money, but the politicians love it because they get to go to the final, they get to have their photographs next to Cristiano Ronaldo, which is good for them when they next get re-elected. They can also go to the population 2 years before the World Cup is hosted and say, look, I've delivered you the World Cup, vote for me. So economically, it's actually a disaster, but for other reasons, these things tend to they tend to be promoted very positively.
Yeah. Three things, actually. That's one of the things we didn't say when we talked about the good news about the Euros possibly being in England and hopefully Scotland. The one thing there won't be is any away fans, I'm guessing. So all those Scottish fans already packing their bags probably can start unpacking. But also, Kieran, I'm on about to point out, because Ali would ask me to say, so it's not just blokes who like gadgets. Remember, you're talking here to a man who still disapproves of Walkmans. Ali loves a gadget. And also, Kieran, we need to have this conversation. I don't know why you lower your voice. I don't even know if you know you do it, Kieran, but when you say I'm a bit of a geek, you always lower your voice and approach the microphone as though you're telling us something we didn't already know. It's not coming as a surprise to any of us, Kieran.
No, guess not.
Trust me. Funny enough, our last question, which is coming up after our penultimate question, involves Cristiano Ronaldo, but these last two questions are clever, if not slightly sinister. Chris Edge says, if God forbid, and I've added the God forbid, if God forbid a League Two player picked up a season-ending injury this weekend, would it be possible to put them on furlough to save a few quid? Also, if a player is suspended after a red card comes, could they be furloughed for just a month? Devious, Chris, devious.
You can be furloughed for a period of a month, but normally furlough requires the agreement of the employee.
Yeah.
So if you've got a player who has had a red card, whilst he will be suspended for three games, in theory, he would not be allowed to attend training, because if he attends training, he is acting as a form of employment. Don't think they get away with it. In terms of the career-ending injury, if I was that player, I wouldn't agree to furlough unless the club agreed to top up my wages to the full level. Because otherwise I'm just going to end up with 80% of, you know, a maximum of £2,500 a month, and I could be in a far more lucrative contract than that. So it's an interesting one. I think some clubs might try to persuade players to go along with that. And where we stand from an ethical point of view, because, you know, we talk about furlough, but its proper name is the job retention scheme.
Yes, of course.
You know, somebody somebody who has a career-ending injury, by definition, there isn't a job being retained, yeah. Sadly.
Yeah, now, our final question, Kieran, and I like this question because it's the sort of question that you ask your mates in the pub, and then you'll go, well, why can't I do that, basically? And somebody will go, well, you just can't, but you may be able to supply the answer. Joe Gill said, can I legally change my name to Cristiano Ronaldo, then sell footballs signed by Cristiano Ronaldo? Well, you could change your name to Price of Football, Joe, and then try and shift a shed load of mugs if you want to. But it's one of those questions. It's inevitably, somebody will say this to you, why can't I just change my name to Cristiano Ronaldo? I'm guessing the answer, Kieran, is that he can't. But
He can legally change his name. I remember a rapper who changed his name to Clint Eastwood.
Okay.
And it was a rapper. This is a long way back. Yes. We then enter into the world of passing off.
Yes.
If you are acting in a manner where you are potentially infringing somebody's intellectual property rights, and you know, we had this discussion a few months ago when Liverpool Football Club tried to claim the rights to the word Liverpool.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, clearly, under those circumstances, the club wasn't going to be successful because, as somebody that works in Liverpool, you know, we are famous for a few other things in the town. There's a few pop beat combos who have sold the odd single or two. So they weren't successful there. If you were trying to do that with Cristiano Ronaldo, he has he's got the intellectual property. He's got a trademark in terms of his signature. So if you try to sign footballs with a signature which is similar to his, then you would be in breach of that those issues. Yeah, and I know we've got lawyers who know this far more depth than I. So I'm not going to go into too much of this, but you would probably. Yeah, I've got members of the family who know one or two things about forgery. And I had a chat with one of my cousins, and he said, yeah, he wouldn't go down that particular route. You'd be far better off just doing other things. I mean, he used to go and sell forged autographs, but he didn't claim to be the person. He just claimed to be an autograph collector. So I think if Joe is going to try to make money down that particular route, I wouldn't go down the changing his name route.
Right. If we get a letter in a year's time from Joe Gill, who's in Pentonville for selling forged autographs, then we will know exactly who to blame, because he's taken the wrong advice here, isn't he? It's interesting, Kieran. I mean, you know, every now and again you'll see a story. We had a story in South London a couple of years back when a local burger bar opened up and they called themselves McDonald's. Yeah, do you know what I mean? But when it's in the local paper, and you think that's quite funny. But then, of course, the next thing you hear is that McDonald's lawyers have just said they're not doing that, because you think no matter how trivial these things are, those multi-million billion corporations aren't going to let you get away with it. And I imagine Cristiano Ronaldo's lawyers are probably wise to this sort of move as well, aren't they?
Oh yes, without doubt. You know, he has an army of advisors who are protecting his image rights on a daily basis, I can assure you.
Yes. Well, if you want to have a question answered for next week's questions pod, it's questions@priceoffootball.com. This may be the last pod for a couple of weeks in which Kieran and I are talking to each other. So I will politely hand you over to Kieran to say goodbye in his usual inimitable way.
Thank you. Thank you. Thanks for all the feedback, folks. If you are enjoying the show, if you can click on the subscribe button, if you can give us a review, ideally a 5-star review, you can write whatever you want. We don't care. You can say that Crystal Palace and Brighton isn't a proper rivalry. Well, we would care about that because we both know that it is. But other than that, just look after yourselves and stay safe. And let's hope that we are able to host the Euro 2020 tournament and attend and go and see some football sooner rather than later.
Hear, hear. The Price of Football.
the price of football.